Greetings and salutations, dear friends, and welcome back to another episode of Lifetime Cinema Club. This is episode 3, and I am your host, Ryan, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend and co-host, Holsh. How are you going, buddy?
Mate, I've been better. Just got a bit of a sniffly nose today, but no, nothing's going to stop me, not for this episode.
Yeah, this is I say this about every movie. I'm a bit of a sucker for these films, especially in this year. 1980 is such a strong year, 1980, but we are on episode 3. Now, last time out, if you were listening to our previous episode, we featured the film that came in at number 9 for the year 1980, and that was The Long Good Friday, directed by John McKenzie, the Cockney crime classic featuring star-making turns for 3 of the actors. Bob Hoskins, Helen Mirren, and Pierce Brosnan all went on to bigger and better things after that. Although I wouldn't say necessarily better. I think it's almost the peak for all three involved, although Pierce Brosnan starred in bigger commercial successes, obviously with 007. But as far as artistic credibility, I would say that is probably my favourite role for all three involved, even though Pierce Brosnan, what, does he say one word in the entire film?
Yeah, just the one. Just the one.
Just the one. It's his. You know, beautiful young looks in that film. I keep saying it. I've got a massive crush on the guy, but he was fearsome in his small time and role in that film. So that was number 9 for 1980. Today, if this is your first time listening to Lifetime Cinema Club, our podcast is based around a project that has been years in the making. We are counting down the 10 best films, in my opinion, from each year of my lifetime, beginning in 1980 and going all the way up to current day. And tonight we are discussing, like I said, the number 8 film. The film that is going to be featured tonight for the year 1980 is a psychosexual masterpiece by the name of Bad Timing.
Welcome to Lifetime Cinema Club.
Bad Timing was directed by Nicholas Roeg, a English director that somehow feels both well-known in some circles and underrated and underseen by a lot of the general film-going and film-watching public. Most of Roeg's most successful and impactful works came in the 70s and early 80s with films like Don't Look Now, starring the recently departed Donald Sutherland, rest in peace. The Man Who Fell to Earth, starring David Bowie in a role that was kind of manufactured for him, but he was also born to play, and Walkabout, which was set in outback Australia. Those three would be, I would argue, Nicholas Roeg's most well-known and most recognisable output. Bad Timing, though, feels as though could be my favourite of his, outside of probably Don't Look Now. It is a film told in a fractured narrative style, relying heavily on flashbacks. So it's skipping regularly backwards and forwards between the past and present. And as such, we won't discuss the film's flow in its chronological layout. Rather, tonight we will discuss what the film is addressing and themes held within, of which there is a lot. And this is a really performance and visually driven film. And I think you would agree with that, Holsh.
The character performances in this are exceptional. And, yeah, like I said earlier, I am not feeling great tonight, but there was just nothing going to stop me when we were featuring a film that has an onus on Art Garfunkel's ballsack. I just think this is a movie that a lot of people are probably going to be a bit uncomfortable with. And if you weren't, then you're probably not human. I really found my first viewing of this film was I was on edge the whole time, just not knowing exactly what it was all drawing to. After watching it again, once again, I got to take in and really draw on what Nicholas Roeg is trying to do with his movies. I think even more than that, every single rewatch, I hated a particular character in this film even more. Every single time, I hated him more. And I know you'll move on to him now, but this is a one-of-a-kind movie for me so far in my movie viewing lifetime.
Yeah, it's a film, and I'm glad you mentioned the uneasiness. For a film that isn't necessarily what you would call a thriller or a definitely not an action film, it leaves a really unsettling feeling in the pit of your stomach through the actions of Art Garfunkel and his ball sack. Like you said, it's a, there's a tremendous shot from behind as he's making love of gravity, not being overly kind to Art's scrotum. But anyway, we could dive into that later on. We might not. That might be all we touch on. Saying touch on Art Garfunkel's scrotum in the same sentence is kind of weird as it is. But there you are. So expect to see that. But also what I'll do to summarize the plot, simply I'll just basically give a very similar synopsis to something like Letterboxd and IMDb because, again, this film, even though it has plot, it is structured in a way where it's a lot of forward and back. And I think just going from point A to point B won't do this film any justice. But for a bit of framework for listeners who perhaps haven't seen Bad Timing, the story is basically it revolves around Alex Linden, who is played by Art Garfunkel, in a performance that if you are only familiar with him from the folk duo Simon and Garfunkel, you are in for a real surprise. So Alex Linden, Art Garfunkel, he's a psychology professor living in Vienna. He's from New York, who meets Milena through a mutual friend. Now, Milena is played by Teresa Russell, who gives, and I'm going to go on about this tonight, just one of the most incredible performances I've ever seen by any actor. They meet through a friend. Though Alex is quite a bit older than Milena, he's attracted to her young, carefree spirit. Despite the fact that Milena is already married, their friendship quickly turns into a deeply passionate love affair that threatens to overtake and consume them both. When Milena ends up in hospital from an overdose and Alex is taken into custody, we are then introduced to police detective determined to find the truth, played by none other than the GOAT, Harvey Keitel. So, yeah, this isn't the only acting credit on Art Garfunkel's resume, but for my money, it's obviously his most well-known performance. In a film that isn't overly well-known, this is one of those type of roles, I guess, that resonates and is notorious for some people without even seeing the movie, especially in film circles. There's a lot of people I've spoken to about this film over the years over the internet that haven't seen Bad Timing but know of Art Garfunkel in this role, and all I say is, oh, is that the movie where he's a real fucking piece of shit? And you're like, yes, it is that film. Absolutely it is. He plays this narcissistic, arrogant, intellectual asshole with such perfection. It's a shame we didn't see more acting roles from him. Would you agree there, Holes?
Yeah, look, the first time I watched it, I thought Milena stole the show completely, but on revisits, you got to give Art credit where it's due. Like, he plays the piece of shit perfectly. There's just so much to dive into with his character. When it comes to someone that can really pull off the obsession, paranoia type, arrogant sod, he does it just to a T in this movie.
He really does. There's been a lot of criticism out there, and this is a film that isn't overly well regarded on those big heavy-hitting sites like IMDb. It's got a decent rating on places like Letterboxd. And a lot of the criticism that is aimed at this film is usually towards Art Garfunkel's performance. And look, I will fess up and say the first time I saw this film, which would probably be about 12 or so years ago now, I left the film thinking, great movie, loved it. I'm big on these psychosexual dramas. But the one thing that was kind of holding me back from saying it was an absolute masterpiece and why I probably underrated it in this year at putting it just at 8 was the fact that I thought that Garfunkel's performance was quite wooden and a bit one-dimensional. That's misunderstanding the performance, and it's really very underappreciated because thinking that he's wooden and that he doesn't have any depth to his character, that's the fucking point, right? So he plays this shallow narcissist. He thinks because he's a professor, he's this intellectual, but he's just a shell of a human. And he's just a manipulative force who hones in on what he desires and with little regard to the object of his desire, which obviously is Milena. And in that kind of framework, how he plays this and who he is in this film is perfection. And I'm like you, Holsch. I still consider Teresa Russell's performance as Milena in this one of the best performances I've ever seen by an actor or actress in any role. But before this podcast and re-watching this for the first time in quite a few years, I'm now of the mindset, much like yourself, that Garfunkel's performance is a lot more nuanced and a lot better than anyone, including myself, I've ever gave it credit for.
I think you'd need to understand the character Alex before you can criticize his performance, because for someone that's just watching it unveil, because there's a lot of unknowns as you're watching this film. If you don't understand from the get-go how Alex functions, how his mind functions, and his view of society around him, then I can totally see why people would be misled. I think you nailed it on the head. I think he's just absolutely perfect for the job, apart from the fact that he's just not the most handsome person in the world for a sexpot like Milena to just go out and sort of start having this, you know, it's obviously obsession both ways in a lot of degrees.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Because there's no way in the world she would stay with this guy unless she had some sort of connection where she just kept drawing her back as well. And maybe that is that intellectual or whatever it is. You know, she's obviously got some issues too. But man, Art Garfunkel, I can't think of a film that I hate a character so much as this, probably since Game of Thrones with the Queen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's got this rat-like feature to him, and I don't ever like honing in on someone's looks, because I can tell you what, right now, I am no oil painting as well, but structurally, his face just suits the type of person he is in this movie. It is perfect casting. This is just a movie all about gaslighting, really, where he manipulates and kind of tries to mentally outmaneuver Milena at every part of their relationship. He's attracted initially to her freewheeling and outgoing and sexual nature, but then wants to reel that in just for himself, only used for him for whenever he wants it, whenever it's on call. And as for Teresa Russell, who plays Milena, she continuously throughout her career has been fearless in her selection of roles. So this is a performance, like I said before, is not only my favourite by her, but close to being one of the best performances I've ever seen by any actor. Russell's career, highlighted by bravery in choosing roles, like I just said, most notably, she worked with Nicholas Roeg again in 1983. That was alongside Gene Hackman in what I call an almost classic, a film called Eureka. Film that strives for greatness and just misses. It's one of those what ifs. There's just a few things missing in that film, and she's prominent in that film alongside Gene Hackman. She also starred in and I wonder if you've seen this, Holsch, because this is of our era, the ultra horny neo noir from 1998 called Wild Things. Did you ever see Wild Things back in the day?
With Neve Campbell and
oh yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember the car washing.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I bet you do. It's hard to forget.
Was that 88?
No, 98.
Oh, 98. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes. It would want to be 98 because I was just of age at that time. Yeah, no. And so were a few of the stars in that movie, thank goodness. But she plays a horny teacher, I believe, in that, which just suits her down to the ground. There's a lot of sexuality in her filmography, right? So she was in Wild Things. She co-starred alongside Dustin Hoffman in one of my favourite films, not just from the 70s, but forever, in a film called Straight Time from 78. And then she also starred in a film called simply Whore, directed by a guy called Ken Russell, who was an absolute lunatic. He directed The Devils back in the 70s as well, which is one of the most controversial films of all time. So basically, that's just a long way of saying Teresa Russell, fearless. I would love for you, Holsch, to go right ahead and drive this along with me. And the reason being is I obviously love this film a lot, right? But I also get lost in it when I watch it. I feel like I'm leering at it, much like the protagonist Alex leers at Milena. And I find myself floating along with the visual kind of trickery that's on display throughout the movie. And I guess it's because I'm more of a vibes guy. I'm into visual storytelling. And I know that you are a researcher and you love to find out the who, what, where, when, and why about stuff. And because of that, we make a really good mix and a good blend of film watcher, both of us. We've got the airy fairy, pie in the sky, oh, look at the pretty colors guy, me. And we've got you who pieces it all together. So I feel like you've unlocked a lot about this film, more so than what I have. So I would love for you to, at times tonight, just take it and run with it, mate. Is this type of storytelling appealing to you? I know for me, I'm really a fan of non-linear storytelling. It kind of unveils different things the more you watch it. How did you find it?
In this instance, I absolutely loved it. And whilst you say it's non-sequential, it's still fluid and moves forward. And that's because of the main thread through this entire film is the hospital investigation piece. Now that it is chronological, it just rolls forward in order. And before we move on to the flashbacks, it's probably important listeners know, they probably have seen it, but at the very beginning, it starts with the two of them walking around a art gallery. It's got the credits rolling. It's got Tom Waits playing.
I was invested from the first second, my first ever viewing of this about, I think it was like 12, 15 years ago. The minute I hear my boy Tom, I'm like, oh, dude, here we go. Let's fucking go. I am tuned in, laser focused. Let's do it.
That's it. And yeah, I was exactly the same. But you're looking at this opening scene in this art gallery and you're thinking, okay, this is going to be a slow moving tale and plot along. And then next second, it just cuts to this screaming of an ambulance siren. Here's this lady in the back that the noises that she makes, so going straight to the sound, the sound that she makes throughout her whole fight for her life is sickening. It just feels like she's on the cusp of death essentially this entire movie when they're using this main thread of the hospital. Then we also have the non-sequential area that you mentioned as well, which are the flashbacks and flash forwards. I think the key to this is all of these flashbacks are essentially Alex, with the exception of a couple that could be seen as sort of shared between Alex and Detective Natusel, which is Harvey Keitel. What it is doing, regardless of what time it occurred, it's all pulling together and getting closer to that end result of finding out why Malena is in such a condition when she's tried to commit a suicide. And that essentially is the story. And it doesn't really unreal until quite late in the piece. But I just think, and this is one of my takes with this, is when you get to know Alex's character, he's a very organized individual. He likes everything to be controlled exactly how he wants it to be. I think he's using these flashbacks to put his life back in order. Everything's getting a bit frazzled here. I'm just going to work back through and make sure that I've just got in my mind everything's okay. When I watch it now, I sort of look at it from that perspective and you can, it sort of makes sense for me that, okay, Alex is just being Alex and just taking care of his own mind, not giving a shit about anyone else. What's your takes, mate, on the flashbacks?
I have a similar take on it, Holsh, whereas I see those flashbacks and everything except for the investigation sequences from Natusel are basically from Harvey Keitel's perspective. Everything else, not necessarily being from a POV camera point of view, but I guess we're seeing this through Alex's recollections. It's basically his perspective, right? So it's his memory or his interpretation of the events. Because he is so controlling, he is trying to control the narrative. Taking that into account, if you can look at this film through that lens to begin with, you will see that throughout the film, Malena is quite sexual and very outwardly sexual and weaponizes her own sexuality, sometimes to her benefit, to get her way in certain spaces and in certain predicaments that she finds herself in. When you think about it, and if you realize that what we're watching is through Alex's version of events, was Malena really that flirtatious in some of those areas? Or was that what we're seeing as a justification of sorts from Alex about his behavior towards her? Is it him trying to say, well, she was acting like, I hate the word, slut? You can tell that's what he thinks of her at times when he can't control her. And showing her being so overly sexual to strangers and different people throughout their relationship, is he muddying the waters? Is he showing us something that we're seeing it, but is it actually what occurred? Or is it Alex's justification of his behavior towards her? When you first see this film, that won't pop out at you, especially if you've got no background on what the film's about. It's human nature. You watch it, it's kind of surface level, and you kind of take it as it is. Man. That's why I'm a massive advocate for if a film niggles at you and scratches the part of your brain where you think there is something more to it, please always rewatch it, even if it's an uncomfortable watch, because this is a film that warrants a lot of rewatches. But if you're going to watch this for the first time, I would definitely recommend, like you said, that the majority of this film, in our take, I think we've got a pretty close take on this, is filmed through Alex's recollections or point of view. And I think with that in mind, you'll take some of Milena's supposed sexualization in this with some grain of salt.
You've just made something click in my mind that I had not considered. The fact that he is sensationalizing it to suit him, the couch scene.
Yep.
The first time.
A pivotal scene.
So he's at work on this particular instance, and he's giving a little lecture to a, well, not a lecture, it almost looks like tutoring to a small group of four or five students. And then Milena comes into his office and lays down on the couch. He is beckoned in to see her by his secretary. And when he goes in, she asks,
"Can I help me, doctor? Is there any chance for him?"
"No.
No, come here, you bitch."
So in that first instance, she's like grabbing him, you know, and ravaging him. But then later on,
"Well, doctor, is there hope for us?"
"Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes."
He recollects that same scene, feeling a bit more trapped in the situation, and she asks the same question, and he's like, "Yes, yes, yes," instead of, you know, basically shunning her off, and he's the one that's going down, and her face doesn't have any of the expression or happiness that he had earlier in the movie. Does that make sense? If you watch those two scenes, it kind of shows how he has manipulated his thoughts initially to basically pin all of the issues coming from her side. But then at the end, it's sort of he's realizing, hey, fuck, maybe it wasn't all it was cracked up to be.
And in turn, he's not only manipulating Milena, but he's manipulating the audience. So what we're seeing isn't exactly how it all shaked out. It's what it shaked out in his head in his justifications. Okay. And that scene in particular, like you said, it's for her to just throw herself at him. This is what he would like to remember, that he was wanted and he didn't even try. It was all her and her seduction on him. And that party scene too, where she puts, where they're in the hallway, she puts her leg up on the other side of the hall. And there's that real steamy flirtation and he plays it ultra cool. And she's the one that's being overly flirtatious with him. To me, that is like a wish fulfillment type of fantasy, right? I see that as him, again, being a narcissist, looking at himself thinking, "I'm so fucking cool. This woman, this stunning woman is just throwing herself at me. She'll be at my beck and call. Whatever I want her to do, she'll do it." And I think this is something that I would love for people going in on their initial watch just to have in the back of their mind. I'd never want to tarnish someone's first watch on a theory of mine or anyone's. Again, I'd love people to go in spoiler and expectation free on every first watch of any film that we talk about. However, sometimes I think at the risk of people walking away from a movie and never going back to it, if they can have a little bit of context going into that first watch, I think it will reward people. And this is something I would love for people to have in their back pocket on that first watch. And it's, you know, she uses her sexuality and weaponizes it throughout the film. And whether or not that is exactly how it happened, you just never know. And every encounter that she has with men throughout this movie, even with her husband, there's a scene at home, she is just sexualized by all of the men in her life. Anyone that she comes into contact with, they just look at her as and treat her like an object, and she's used to it. So she takes advantage of that because this is how her world works. Is it to the extent of Alex's point of view that we're seeing? Maybe not. It's probably exaggerated a lot, but it is still something that she has to deal with. And this whole movie is about that. It's about the male gaze. Now that's become like the term toxic relationship and male gaze. They are both very real things. They've become a bit buzzwordy and people kind of drop those type of phrases a lot. But this is what this film is about. Yeah, this is about male gaze.
I've got a question now on the back of your observation. Now that you've stated that, now I can see them coming from Alex's point of view. So when Milena's having sex with Stefan and she's showing no expression, no love in her eyes as it's happening, and remember how she walks away, leaves the keys, and she has this massive smile on her face. It's like a crazy awesome moment in the film. That's all from Alex's perception.
Yep, it's all his point of view. All his point of view. She's not interested in her husband at all. Never loves him. It's because she loves Alex. And everything is geared towards him and the feeding of his narcissistic ego. Absolutely. But this is all. These are all little instances that when you watch the film the first time, they seem odd. There are little inconsistencies in how she acts and how he acts in certain parts of this film. But when you look at it in this way, it all just makes sense that this is all a fantasy of Alex. This is his justification for driving this woman to suicide is because she's the crazy one, not me. She was the one that was overly sexual. I was trying to get her to lead a nice, respectful, organized life. It is his justification. And the truly brutal moments that paint Alex in a poor light are always from the perspective of Natusel. He can see through his bullshit. Mm-hmm. And Harvey Keitel is the perfect dude to play that role. He just sees through. He just looks at this guy and thinks, this guy is an absolute dirtbag. I know he's driven this woman to this. He has manipulated this woman, didn't care about this woman, and wants to fucking nail him, which is great. And look, another scene that I think really sums it up too, Holsch, is when they're on vacation and they've got the broken down vehicle. Those two guys come along in the truck, and it just, the camera just leers on Russell and on the open buttons with her breasts almost exposed. Then she's in the front seat with the guys while Alex is in the tray as they're getting driven back to the town, and he can see that they're trying to like grab her knee, and she's just laughing and flirting with them, and he's just getting more and more irate. He's blaming her the whole time.
Yeah, this all makes
you're
so
asking
much
for
more
it.
Sense.
You're asking for it. You're asking for it. It's always that.
I've got to watch this again now. That's amazing. It just, it pulls everything into line.
The power dynamic is incredible in this, between the two. And I've said this now three times. We've had three episodes and I've said this three times, that the rewatches on these films, so Inferno, first of all, The Long Good Friday, and now this, have not only been kind or have not only reinforced the fact that they deserve to be in my top tens, but they've improved the films dramatically. Inferno, loved it more than ever on my recent rewatch, and the same with The Long Good Friday. But out of those three, no film has improved more on these recent rewatches than Bad Timing, to the point that if we hadn't have just launched into this, which we had to do, we had to start somewhere, right? Which I've had these lists for fucking years and never did anything with them. At this point in time, Bad Timing would be probably my number two for 1980, and it's only being kept out of the number one spot, and I'm not going to spoil what that is, by a film that is so important to me in my film watching lifetime. I'm obsessed with Bad Timing, and it's a film about obsession. We haven't even touched on really the visual dynamic at work and what Rogue and cinematographer, who I have forgotten, hang on, sorry mate, Anthony Richmond was the cinematographer. Now that dude worked with Rogue a few times. I worked with Rogue on Don't Look Now, which is one of the most richly photographed films ever. And again, if I'm ranking Rogue films, Bad Timing is just right up there now, especially after these last two rewatches I've had. Don't Look Now would probably still be my favorite of his, but Bad Timing is so fucking close. He had a pretty interesting career. So he has Don't Look Now and The Man Who Fell to Earth and Bad Timing, three incredible masterpieces from Nicholas Rogue, as well as the 90s horror classic Candyman, which was a really well-shot urban horror. And he's also got an underrated film from the late 90s called Ravenous, which is a cannibal Western that everyone must see. Incredible movie. But Anthony Richmond, the cinematographer for this film, also has credits for Legally Blonde, Alvin and the Chipmunks, and Diary of a Wimpy Kid. So this dude goes from fucking heavy, heavy material to the lightest of lighthearted stuff you can think of.
Wow.
But yeah, like we haven't even touched on the visual flourishes in this whole. So like one thing that you instantly picked up on, and I'm stoked you did, and it shows that your eye for cinema is really in tune, are those snap zooms that Rogue does.
Yeah, look, Rogue's got so much in the way that he shoots with the symbology, the zoom ins, and a lot of the different pieces of art, etc., that he uses right through this film, and also the colors and fashion choices through it. Like all of this combined is phenomenal, because one of the first things I read before I'd even watched the movie was Nicholas Rogue doesn't put something in a movie without a reason. Yeah, Rogue uses zoom-ins regularly throughout the film to further help capture how Alex's mind works, and it accentuates certain parts that are coming through the lens of this creep. Now, there's several zoom-ins on Milena's face where he's interrogating her, you know, for example, when she asked if she was married. And when you look at it later on as a reflection or a flashback, he obviously knows when he's going back to this scene that she was married. And then in this occasion, it's like the camera has just hard zoomed onto her face because in his mind, she's a liar. So, you know, he's using that scene to portray her as a villain in his eyes. It's also become more obvious now that these moments from Rogue do help further manufacture Alex's visions to confirm in his own mind that, you know, he was correct in his own affirmations the whole time. He was always right. There's also times during the current day investigation scenes that aren't flashbacks when the zoom will be on like completely inanimate objects like steam bursting out of a pipe or a fire extinguisher. Once again, I think this is just capturing Alex's absolute zero care on the tragedy around him as he hones in on completely irrelevant details. But my favorite in the whole movie is when he's talking to the nurse and the nurse is right in his face, and then Keitel is walking past in the background and it zooms in to Keitel and here he is winking at Alex, basically, and then the focus abruptly reverts back to the nurse, like Alex was a kid, you know, caught doing the wrong thing at school. The paintings at the gallery. So at the beginning, they show these two paintings. Now, one of them's by a very famous painter, Klimt, and it's called The Kiss, and it's quite a vibrant and colourful painting, and Milena comments on
One of my favourite paintings, too. I actually bought a rip-off copy of this in a big frame for my wife many years ago for one of her birthdays. I love this painting.
There you go. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it, you know, it's quite vibrant and Milena's taken by it. And she mentions, because they revisit this scene later to give it some context. And Alex said, Milena says, you know, they look happy. And Alex's reply to that is, that's because they don't know each other well enough yet. Which, you know, everything revolves back to, you know, what has happened between them. But then they walk through the gallery and they pass this other painting, which is called Death and a Maiden by Schiel. I'm not sure of the pronunciation.
Yeah, I will just fuck that up too. I'm not even going to attempt that one.
But yeah,
another one you mean.
So yeah, and it's I had a bit of a read about this one, and it's basically death that has a stranglehold. So it's got this male that's sort of hunched over this lady and got her arms around her, and he looks really messed up, as in old, frail, almost zombie-like, and he's got a head, and it represents death that's holding this lady in a stranglehold. And Alex remarks to this one, definitely happy. At least I hope so. So once again, like, to him, that painting represents the ideology that he wants in his life. It's, you know, you just stay under my arms until, you know, that's it, until death. You'll be mine. So did you have any thoughts with the paintings before I keep moving on?
No, mate, I think you've nailed all of that. It's a great scene to open up to and obviously go back and call back on. And again, because these paintings are something that Alex and the audience and everybody. They leer at you. Go to an art gallery. You're observing. You're a voyeur. You're looking at these beautiful objects that are on the wall, and you're imagining owning it.
Yeah.
and that is what Alex is doing this entire time.
Yeah.
This entire time is what he's doing. The only person that's seeing through his bullshit is Milena, and obviously Detective Natusel. Pivotal scenes, and I just love the way they've incorporated the artworks into this. The location shooting on this film is incredible too. You know, the vacation scenes, the footage of the ambulance at the start racing through the streets of Vienna, and you're not following them. The ambulance is actually chasing us. Seeing that visual, those shots as the ambulances are flying towards us in these busy streets at night is incredible. The camera work in those, they're only a very short snippet of scenes, are just remarkable. I just cannot get over the visual flourishes in this film. There's like minimal flair at some points. There's really great examples of tracking shots through crowds, like when Alex is back at the university and he sees Milena through the window in that scene and she's seeing somebody else. Mm-hmm. And then he like tracks her out into the busy courtyard. You know, the camera work, how it follows Alex through that is remarkable as well. Everything is just so well done in this film. It's of its time, but it's also ahead of its time.
Also, the way that they camera the flashback with the surgery and the investigation, how they have the cut scenes in it, and it looks like they almost, they're sharing that same moment together.
The editing in this film is incredible. It pisses me off no end. So the guy that edited this is a guy called Tony Lawson, and he had a massive career, and he did a lot with Nicholas Roeg too. But this guy is a god of editing because, if only for one other film, he edited Kubrick's Barry Lyndon as well, which is one of the most beautifully photographed and filmed movies of all time. But the editing in that film is just exquisite. This is what pisses me off about things like the Academy and the Academy Awards, is that they don't take in enough outsider art. Not that this is what you would call a cult film or pulpy kind of fiction. It's got pulp kind of flourishes to it at times, but it's still outside of the typical Oscar bait that the Academy look at. And it is a crime that both the cinematographer Anthony Richmond and the editor Tony Lawson didn't get any props, to my knowledge. I don't think they were nominated for an Academy Award for this. They deserve to be. The editing in this film, like you said, the cross-cutting between the present, the now, the hospital scenes and the flashbacks and flash forwards, not only the editing visually, but the sound design and the syncing up of certain like gargles and gurgles that she's making on the hospital bed during her overdose and their attempts at saving her sometimes meld into a flashback.
I think the two that really stick in my mind out of those cross cuts is the one where she has those choking, gurgling noises from having sex with Alex, and then it spins across to her making the same noises, and then a second later they cut her throat open for the tracheostomy.
Tracheotomy. Einschnitt. Warte.
That scene in particular is incredible, and look, highly, like, it's graphic, it's jarring when you see that in this film. And like I said before, it's weird saying that this is a thriller. It's a psychological sexual drama, but it's got thriller elements, and that scene in particular is horrific. And we said before too that we didn't want to focus on a linear plot, kind of blow by blow, play by play, scene by scene rundown on this film. But there are some scenes I would like to touch on, and I know you would as well. The staircase sex scene in this, it's the culmination of a really heartbreaking lead up. Previous to this, she has substance abuse issues. Again, has this been amplified by Alex's recollection? Is he exaggerating this to, you know, to comfort himself into thinking, I've done nothing wrong? But, you know, throughout we are led to believe that Milena has issues with alcoholism. And at the scene before this, he is very critical of her and her tidiness in her own apartment, which leads to her inviting him back a few days later, and he arrives, and her previously messy apartment is now absolutely spotless. She's dressed nicely for him, and all she wants to do is spend some quality time together. Yeah, maybe have a few wines, smoke a few cigarettes, listen to some music, but just chill. And yet, all he wants to do is fuck. This scene is the only scene in the entire movie, in this particular part within the scene, Holsch, where I kind of find a flaw in my rationale, in that this is the part where it doesn't paint Alex in the hero sense that he has given him. It's not the hero sense, that he was in the right.
And you know and why? I can answer that for you right now, because yeah, this is one that's put through Natusel's eyes.
Well, he is at the staircase trying to visualize what had happened, because he sees the aftermath, right, of her meltdown. And that's exactly right. Is that what you're alluding to?
Natusel, who seems to be some sort of voyeur, clairvoyant of sorts,
yeah, when he looks at this. They kind of touch on that a bit, don't they? They kind of almost make him out to be some type of a medium that yeah, can kind of see a crime scene.
Yeah, and there's moments where it crosses from him seeing or believing, reenacting a sex scene or the stair scene, and it goes back to him. He's got a little grin, or another time it rolls back to him. He like licks his lips because he's actually enjoying it, what he's considering. So yeah, he's
so this must character. Be you're right, and I did kind of forget that, but he Natusel is at the door, isn't he, and looking in at the apartment. So this is actually from Natusel, not Alex's point of view. Yeah. You're right.
This is all coming together.
Yeah.
That makes complete sense as well. Like everything, I'm so glad you shared your views at the beginning, because everything really starts to make sense. And it just puts Milena's character into, it really means we knew nothing. I mean, we know a little bit, but really we knew very little about Milena in this entire film.
Absolutely. She's purely there for Alex's sexual gratification, basically. We know for a person, or for a character to have so much emotional heft and weight in the way she performs and the absolute range of emotions that she has to go through in this role with Teresa Russell, again, just giving the performance of a lifetime, we know very little about the true Milena in this. Mm. And that's the real tragedy of it all. And what we're seeing through, I guess now what we've figured out is Natusel's point of view is that all Alex does is he just turns up, he's just trying to fuck. He doesn't care that she's done all this for him and that she wants to spend quality time with him. And she declines. She's like, well, no, I just want to relax. I just want to hang out with you. Can't we just talk? And as soon as that happens, Alex just loses all interest in her. He's like, oh, well, I've got to go. I've got somewhere I've got to be. And instantly she's like, why? You're just... And that is that all I am to you? You're just gaslighting me into doing everything that you want. And the moment you don't get your way, you leave. She runs out of that staircase. She starts undressing herself in a pretty, for the time, I don't want to say graphic, but a very raunchy scene where we get full frontal nudity. Again, a very brave performance from Teresa Russell. And basically they fuck in a very primal, animalistic fashion on the staircase.
Alex. You want me? Huh? Huh? Come on. Come on. Do it now, Alex. Do it now. Here it is, Alex. Here it is. Look at it, Alex. Alex! That's what you wanted, huh? There it is, Alex. Come here. Come here. Come here. Take it. That's what you want. Here it is. Come on. Huh? What you wanted? Then do it now. Fuck me. Fuck me right here now, God damn it.
Oh, fuck you.
Huh? Stick it in there then, huh? Ooh, that's it.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
There are rooms below them and you can hear people walking up and down the stairs. Again, great sound design. You can hear the people at the rooms downstairs walking. You can hear doors opening and shutting. And it's a really quick, animalistic sexual encounter. And there must be something about staircases, because when I was watching this, I was instantly reminded of a sex scene from David Cronenberg's A History of Violence. It's a real similar kind of sex scene. It's just a lack of intimacy and emotion, and it's this pure primal sexual undertones in that as well. But after they finish their primal sexual encounter, obviously Alex, being the piece of shit he is, he just gets up and leaves. And then it basically fuels that full-blown meltdown from Lena. It basically triggers the downward spiral that's been bubbling away for a while, and that you know is coming because of the current present-day scenes of her in peril in hospital. Mm. And that just kickstarts everything, really, the downward spiral for Milena. It's a pivotal scene in a film filled with those. That's obviously the scene that is a real turning point. Again, I don't want to get too bogged down in particular scenes. Is there anything else you'd like to put out there, mate, as far as scenes that really meant a lot to you in the flow or the understanding of the film?
There's a couple other scenes that I really enjoyed. This one wasn't so key as far as it didn't really grab me, but I think it's one that a lot of people have sort of just skipped by a lot, is the Moroccan holiday. There's a moment that, until I'd watched it a couple of times, that didn't really click with me, but it shows Milena and Alex back in the hotel that they're staying at. She's doing some painting, which we see later on, some of her paintings. Natusel picks them up, and a lot of them are abstract sort of sexual paintings of women, and one of them, I think, is of Alex himself.
One thing I love about that, sorry to interrupt,
yeah,
is the one of Alex doesn't show him in a very good light as far as his endowment. I will say that. He's not packing a lot of heat in that caricature that she's drawn.
Or his physical, you know, his physique is pretty wretched in that one as well.
And she's really emphasised the rat face. Again, I hate criticising people's physical appearance, but she really hones in on the nose and forehead, that's for sure.
Oh, dear. I mean, back to the Moroccan scene, like he's talking about this, and it's the first time in the entire movie that you hear him talking about himself and his previous life as a child, and he's telling this really mournful story, and it sounds like, if you didn't listen to the words, and it might sound like a story about how he'd lost a family member, or he'd lost his, you know, his puppy had passed away, and you know, it was
this just, is about the building that he loved, the old building.
It's about a fucking building, and that's the thing. Like, for him, when he has to pinpoint a really amazing or sad moment in his life, he talks about a building that got pulled down.
Side of the park was this beautiful old mansion. It's very elegant, aristocratic. It made me feel good knowing something so beautiful was so close. Around it were lots of other lovely buildings, mostly built, I think, around the turn of the century. One by one they went down, and one by one up went mostly monstrosities. But that one building remained. It was there. Someone said an eccentric millionaire owned it. At night as a kid, when I'd walk across the park, I'd use it to guide me. Then later, when I'd graduated, started to teach, it was still there. One day I had to go to Boston. That was Friday. When I got back on Tuesday, it was gone. Gone. Like that. What?
Nothing. He doesn't have that affinity with humans and people, and that connection. It's objects, and just the fact that this object had disappeared out of his life was one of the, you know, the most torturous things. So, you know, this was his childhood story, and it just, to me, like, I didn't really pick up on it the first couple of times, but it's a really key scene for showing how he is very emotionless with other people and doesn't really have the ability to connect, almost.
Yeah. It's like a sociopathy. He just cannot relay or relate to human emotion.
That's right. And at the end of this particular scene, Milena's trying to listen to it and all the rest, and he's gone, "Oh, are you okay?" And she's like, "Yeah." And then she's like almost violently like swats a mosquito on her neck and then gets a repellent spray, like the old push sort of pump repellent spray, and then this sneeze that's once again almost violent as well. To me, like, that whole scene feels like when he finally starts revealing herself to her, she's allergic to him to a degree.
Yeah. You told me about this. You text me after seeing that scene and describe what you just said. And you're like, I get it. It's like he's just finally opening up as only he can really do himself, because again, it's objects over people. And she's almost allergic to his bullshit, I think, is what you said to me.
Yeah.
It was like, she's just like, oh, for fuck's sake. Like, just treating him like an annoying insect. But yeah, that's a great takeaway from that scene, Holmes.
And the other big scene that I thought was really amazing, it's sort of two parts to it, but it's the one where he's sitting in that cafe or something with some associates, and the one where you mentioned he sees her outside the window with another gentleman and then follows her through the university. They see each other, they start talking, and everything is in focus at this point. And it's showing some of their inner thoughts. One of them, for example, is like, in his mind, he's thinking, oh, she's lost her tan. And then he just fucking comes out and says, you lost your tan. He just, he doesn't think about tweaking anything to make it sound better to the person that's receiving the start of this conversation. He just says what he thinks, because he doesn't have the ability in himself to try and pair it in a way that is caring to the recipient. So he does that. And anyway, they're chatting for a little bit. And then eventually he asks,
who's the guy?
Does it matter? Maybe I wanted to stumble into you.
Sounds reasonable, but how can I believe you?
The way they shoot this, all of the background gets blurrier and blurrier and blurrier. And it's all of a sudden, you can feel that it's just the two of them are just trapped in this conversation, because he's gone back to the same fucking shit, the questioning, the interrogation, and it's back to just all that matters is him and her. And this is reflective in the whole film, because the whole film, he doesn't ever want her to be around friends, be around anyone else. Not just men, anyone. That's how bad his paranoia is. And the whole film in his mind should be just him and her. And I just thought the way that they cameraed this was so clever and so powerful. That was the first part of the scene. And then she goes off, pissed off. But then, being the creep that he is, he sits in his car all night long and waits for her outside her apartment. Eventually, she walks back and she's, you know, drunk and tired and not ready for someone to jump out of the car. She just wants to get to bed.
And he just starts lecturing her as well, you know, like, who the fuck are you, dude? Seriously.
Yeah, and he says at this point, I just can't stand to think of you with anyone else. And then I think this is one of the greatest dialogues from Milena. It's like,
I waited all night out there in the car. It's fucking daylight.
You want me to tell you I slept with someone? Is that what you want? We fucked? Do you believe that? Is that what you want to believe? What do you want to know? The truth? No, you don't call it a lie. What do you want to do? Go up and make love? Go up and fuck? You want us to do that? You want me to do that? What is it you want? I don't love you. What do you want me to say? What do you want me to do because of that? Kill myself? Would you be sure then? Huh? Would you? Would you?
Yeah, that. Oh. Yeah. in a film that makes me so angry against the protagonist, that particular part just drives me insane. Because he's just exposed him for what he is, who he is. He can't handle it. And he takes it on her, not only mentally but physically. It's an incredible monologue and piece of dialogue from Russell, from Milena. Again, a powerhouse performance. And again, facing off against an absolute weasel, an absolute manipulating monster. He might look like this meek, like we said before, like not exactly the most intimidating physique, but he's just got this controlling way about him the entire time. Incredible scene.
That one and the stair scene, without a doubt, the two most captivating scenes. And I would actually put them, even though we have to touch on the last scene yet, I think they're my two favourite scenes. And both of them are from Teresa Russell's acting and dialogue and the way she executes it, because you are torn with her in the way that she just fuck it. She's menacing in the stairs, and then in the one when he meets him, her back, it's on the stairs again, the second dialogue. Yeah. Like both times, she's tortured in the second one.
And not long after this is another example of Alex's point of view when he receives the call, the suicidal call from Milena, and it's in the middle of having sex with a different woman. The line that sticks out on me is she tells him that she's going to kill herself and that she's done something silly and all this kind of stuff. And he's then trying to say, right in front of this woman who he's just previously been, you know, having sex with, basically says, look, I need to talk to you. We need to catch up. We need to figure things out. I really miss you, all this kind of stuff. And then she goes, oh, for fuck's sake, and basically just hangs up on him. And the only thing he says is, I hate to be hung up on. Fucking height of this dude, man. And you can tell this is from his perspective because he plays it cool, and the woman that he has previously been penetrating and then stops to take a phone call from his ex-girlfriend is still laying there next to her. She hasn't just got up and left like any other normal respect person with any self-respect would do. Mm. She's laying there. She might be rolling her eyes a couple of times, but she lights a smoke for him, gives him a cigarette and goes, oh, was that her? Like, there's no way in the world. Like, she's still kind of half fawning over this guy who has just disrespected her 2 seconds prior. So it's another scene where it's just that, you know, he receives a suicidal phone call and then she just listens, the woman he's making love to just listens to him take that phone call, and then all he can say, the only remark he says is, I hate to be hung up on. Yeah. There's no concern for Milena. No. There's no concern for the girl with him. It's purely something that affected him and him only.
It's great that you brought up the scene, because the scene after it is also a very visual scene where he actually does go to see Milena, and she has the most amazing makeup on, this clown face, this outfit. And we haven't got a chance to touch on the colors yet, but in this particular scene, she's dressed as this clown. Once again, she's unreal.
Welcome to the week! James, you can lock me up and I'll forever be yours. Did you bring your orange file for protection, huh? Oh, don't worry about it. Doesn't matter. You've won.
I've won?
We are celebrating the death of the Milena you don't want and the birth of the Milena you do want. Gonna pretty up a bunch of like... Here, for you. The only one, sir. The only one, chains for which you have the only key.
And she's dressed in all black and white, representing like both his lack of emotion and his autistic take on everything. You know, it needs to be all or nothing, yes or no. And with the whole film, like Milena wears the most vibrant colors. She's got all these amazing brooches that she puts up on her gown, birds and butterflies and, you know, all these emblems of her free spirit. Whereas Alex the whole time is very super drab, you know, always beige and browns and grays and just really boring fuck. There's a scene actually where Alex and Natusel interacting with this picture of a labyrinth. And I won't have to go into it. The labyrinth is quite explanatory where, you know, it's, I think, a bit of a symbol of how Milena's in a trap that she's never going to get out of. But it's funny because Natusel does mention in different parts of the film that he's very similar to Alex in some ways and the way they think and so forth. And Natusel's home is very plain as well as yep. Alex. And anyway, Alex is putting up the labyrinth picture and Natusel's taking it down, which I think once again is a metaphor of Natusel trying to sort the shit out and Alex just getting it all in place again. But at the end of this little moment as well, it swings to Malena on the phone because Alex is being a prick calling her and not saying anything. And the moment it swings to Malena, it's like bright red shading on her face and the background's red and her lips are like really nice red lipstick. And all of a sudden the film goes from something that was almost monotone to this
very
like,
drab, yeah,
to something that could have fit into Inferno because of the beautiful reds that are shown with Malena. And I think the way he uses colours right through the film and, you know, at the end, how it is even affecting Malena, I just think it's incredible. So rolling into the last scene, now the whole film, just to sort of put a bit of context in this last scene, revolves around a three-hour time period. So it's between when Malena takes the pills right up until where the shot is now in the hospital, which when she takes the pills, the clock next to her states 10:20 p.m. Natusel is obviously piecing all this together and he's got some incredible techniques where he notices the car radio, where the radio was still on, but back in those days, certain channels stopped at midnight and the late channel would start at midnight. And he had the car radio on one of the channels that stopped at midnight.
I love that little interplay there where one of the police officers say, oh, it's because this plays until this hour and that does that. And Natusel basically says to them, how the fuck do you know? Aren't you using your police scanners at that time? Shouldn't you be doing like trying to solve crimes? They're basically saying that they're not doing their job because they're listening to the radio instead.
Natusel's he's switched on, this man. But yeah, so that's one of the first giveaways because he actually admits, and he doesn't admit to much. And another, he like even through the whole investigation, the thing that probably irks me more than anything is he tells the detectives.
Would you say she sounded excited?
Say whatever you like.
No, Dr. Linden, what you would like.
And you just want to punch him in the face. But so he uses that and he works out that there's these cigarettes that, because he's very specific, only smokes one type of cigarette. And he finds out that there's a number of these cigarettes still in Malena's apartment in the cigarette tray. And also he works out that this toxic process of Malena, it takes around 3 to 4 hours. And when she goes downhill in a really bad way when it comes to her motor skills.
Mrs. Vodnik rang you between 1 and 1:30, which means she was in a condition to dial and talk.
So?
She arrived at the hospital about 1 hour later in a state of advanced coma.
So?
So? An abnormally rapid toxic process, wouldn't you say?
Hmm? Not my branch. Ask a specialist.
I have. When Mrs. Vodnik reached the hospital, she had swallowed the pills at least 3 or 4 hours before. If she swallowed the poison, let's say between 10:30 and 11:30, then at 1:30 she was in no condition to ring anybody. Or even move a finger.
This last scene that you're just waiting for, it hit me so hard when it started happening. And essentially, Alex heads to the apartment and Malena is now at that point where her motor skills aren't working or they're just on the absolute crisp of still functioning a little bit. He is just the biggest arsehole. He can see she's slumped like a doll in the corner.
And this is what he's wanted the entire time, really. This is what he has wanted to be able to just use her at his will, basically. And he turns up, like you said, and she's basically comatose and completely she just cannot move. And what you're about to say is just harrowing, but yes.
One of the first parts in the scene that many probably wouldn't have noticed on an initial watch is it actually refers to an earlier scene in when he walks into Milena's apartment when he's depicting her as very intoxicated, reading a book and playing a record. It has this the music has a real Snake Charmer vibe to it, which goes hand in hand with the Morocco scene, I guess. Alex just stomps in and rips the needle off the record and, you know, looking down at her, and she's like, what the fuck are you doing? In this final scene, while she's there laying comatose, can't move, he puts on that same record while he contemplates what he's going to do to her. She reaches for the phone and this sick bastard goes and pulls it out of the wall, and he just takes so much time. In fact, even before he lands there and he'd had the call where she's explained, she's saying goodbye, he goes to a fucking bar first.
Yeah.
So it's taken him a matter of hours to get to her. That's why she's in such a bad state. Through the whole film as well, he has a pen knife that he ticks along all the time, almost like a ticking clock. And he uses this. He pulls her up, lays her out neatly on the middle of the bed, and he starts cutting off her clothing down the middle and opening it up like a zip.
It's just horrific. It's the act of pure degradation on her. And again, this must be coming. He would never look at himself in this way. He wouldn't glorify himself. So we're obviously looking at Natusel's vision or perspective in this. He is the act of what you would see a serial killer do, a complete sociopathic, psychopathic act of complete control.
It's a horror scene, essentially.
Yeah. And look, the film does build to this. It doesn't just happen. Like, we know that this guy is a narcissist and doesn't truly care for anyone or anything, but this is still a jarring leap at the end. And now it makes sense once you see this scene as to why Natusel, Harvey Keitel, has such a bee in his bonnet for this dude.
Mm.
Initially, through the film, you're like, this guy's really on his case about being a negligent boyfriend as far as not responding quick enough. Like, yeah, that is wrong. Absolutely. But then you realize that he has suspected all along that not only was there negligence and manipulation and physical and mental violence, but there was also the possibility of rape.
He's fucking Milena, who's essentially lifeless, and it's the first time that he's like, professing how much he loves her. I love you, I love you, I love you. There's this sickening moment where you see her open her eyes, just that little bit. She's obviously got no control, no function, but she knows what's happening to her as this sick fuck does what he's doing and just fulfilling himself. And it's just horrendous.
It's funny, you know, it might play tame to some people these days, but then again, it probably doesn't. But this is still a shocking conclusion to a film. Mm. And it is a famously one of the big film critics of the time. I don't know if it was Siskel or Ebert or one of the film critics from the UK. I think they famously said something along the lines of, this is a sick movie for sick people.
Yeah.
It got a lot of bad press at time of release. It's like we said earlier in the episode tonight, it has been reassessed as a classic in some circles. It's still underseen as far as I'm concerned, but this is a harrowing end to a film if ever I've seen one.
Well, it disappeared for 20 years off the surface of the earth. So Rank were the distributor or the production initially, and they only actually screened it or showed it very briefly. So it wasn't on for very long.
I never realized this.
Yeah, and then no one could get a hold of it until I think it was like 1999 or something. A copy came out.
Well, you know, that makes sense for my timeline, because I was trying to think of when I saw it, and I think I said before 15 years, which is probably being a little bit generous. I think it may have been before that. I, as a young fella, worked a few different jobs, and one of my part-time jobs was at Video Easy, which was a video rental store, around not the beginning of the DVD craze, which was like the late 90s, but I think it must have been around 2003, 2004. I'm pretty sure that's when I bought Bad Timing on DVD. I didn't even realize, I didn't even research that for tonight, Hulse. You just told me something that is incredible, that it was pretty much not banned, but kind of held back from being shown for 20-something years.
I think its cult status might be actually a lot larger if it had been available through that whole period and gave people time to actually realize what a
great piece of art it was. Well, it's playing catch up now, really, isn't it?
It is. It is.
That final, like complete final scene at the end, after we've gone through that absolutely disgusting act of Alex's in Malena's apartment, is he's leaving a hotel in New York, and he's back in his hometown, and she's back there too, but he doesn't know that. He walks out, gets into a cab, turns around and sees Malena with a new haircut, but sees the scar on her throat, yeah, which was needed to save her life from her overdose, yells out at her, and she just blankly looks back and turns her head on him, and you see him looking all feeble and meek in the back of this cab as it whisks away. It's a fitting end to a true depiction of a piece of shit.
To me, the best word of that last scene to characterize him is pathetic. And that's the way she's looking at him. And when he looks back through the window, almost like with his nose pushed up against the glass, it's like...
Looks like a child. He looks like a child that's about to cry, that hasn't got his way.
That's the real Alex that is caught there, not all his visions of himself. That's the real Alex, the fucking pathetic little weed.
Absolutely. And the thing is too, like, and we've just basically just said it now, like... We talk about how brave Russell's performance is, but how brave is this performance from Garfunkel? Like, he is willing to put himself out there as one of the most despicable people I've ever seen in a film. And he plays it so well. And again, I was one of these people too. I wasn't as harsh as a lot of people were about his performance in this. I wasn't to the point of saying he was terrible. Well, a lot of people on initial release back in 1980 just threw him under the bus, said it was terrible, he should stick to singing, he should never act again, all these kind of things. And whilst I found it, again, like I said earlier, a little bit wooden at first, it is perfect for the character he is playing. He is a complete empty vessel. He only has his own interests at heart. He cannot convey emotion, doesn't feel actual emotion. The only emotion he would feel would be anger and lust.
And paranoia.
And paranoia, that's the other one too. Yeah, absolutely. He's just unable to feel anything else. And you know, so him being that kind of wooden type of person in this film is just the perfect way to play it.
And the way you say that as well, when he hasn't got that emotion, etc., if you watch the film, the only time he ever apologizes or acts nice to Malena is every time that he thinks he's going to lose her. And it's almost more a procedural thing for him. He's like, okay, I'm going to lose it. I need to do something nice. So I'm sorry.
Yeah, I've got to reel her back in. Yeah. I've got to reel her back in some way.
But it's not an emotional response. It's just a calculated response.
Because it's with him too. It's the not only is the thrill of having complete ownership of something, it's the thrill of the chase. He loves the fact that, not the chase, but, well, I guess it is in some sense. You know, that initial flirtation scene at the party, you can see he's really getting off on that. Mm. And it's almost as if he likes to push until the brink and then bring it back in. And that way he can justify and feel gratification in himself that no matter what I say or do, she'll always come back to me. Look, incredible film. Do you have anything else you'd like to add, Hulse? I'm pretty much spent on this one, although after these last rewatches, I definitely, like I said before, I'm elevating this to the upper echelon of my favorites, like all time. And I think I supremely underrated this at number 8 in my ranking for 1980.
The only last thing I'll add is I think we have not mentioned the best quote of the film, and this quote is from the real Malena, and it's in the form of a note that Natusel finds. And I haven't got the whole thing written down, but she says, "I wish you'd understand me less and love me more." That's the one snippet that is actually the true Malena, and I think that is really special in the movie.
It is, absolutely. And that, and like you said, we don't get to see a lot of the true Milena. Very, very small snippets of it, because, again, we're looking through Alex's eyes and his justification throughout most of the film. But that quote is just brilliant and spot on too. A good summary of the type of person she is and the type of person Alex is.
I'm just blown away by these first three films. So who knows what's going to happen with the next 200 that we've got to get through. But I'm excited, mate. I'm so excited.
Excellent. I'm excited that you're excited. I'm pretty chuffed, because besides probably something like The Longer Friday, last week's episode, which is a film that I think most people would enjoy, I have thrown a couple of curveballs at you initially with Inferno and Bad Timing.
Yeah,
aren't easy watches, but you've taken to them really well.
Yeah, look, I've been outside my comfort zone for nearly all your films so far, apart from probably Long Good Friday, and I can't reveal next week's, but next week's really put me out of my comfort zone as well. And you know what? After watching a few and understanding them, I go into every film now in a much broader context and very open-minded compared to what I was before I started this project. So already I know for myself I've evolved in a real appreciative sort of way to approach movies. So I really thank you for that.
Awesome. I'm stoked to hear it. That'll be it for tonight. So our number 8 for the year 1980 is Bad Timing. I encourage everyone who hasn't seen it to please do so, obviously. And if you have seen it and loved it, return to it and watch it again. And there is so much to unlock. And if you have seen it and didn't like it, I hope that you've listened to this tonight and it's given you reason to go back to it and hopefully attack it with some fresh eyes. But on behalf of both of us, thank you very much for tuning in. We will continue our journey next week with our number 7 for 1980. No sneak peeks or tips on what that will be. There'll be another controversial one, another one that faced a lot of backlash from the censors at time of release. So I'm looking forward to your thoughts on this one, Holsh.
Yeah, I think that's a clue in itself. So let's leave
I couldn't help myself. I could not help myself. Had to give a little semi-spoiler to that one. But yeah, we'll be back next week with number 7 in our list for the year of 1980. And from Holsh and I at Lifetime Cinema Club, thank you very much. And we'll talk to you again soon.